Good evening. Thank you. Wonderful to see all of you. Hello there. I'm so excited that you came early. You must be the nerds of the audience, or something. I'm Andrew Crust. It's really great to be here. It's been a wonderful week so far. I've kind of been all over town. One of our musicians here in this orchestra, percussionist Carrie Knodel, has given me a tour which I think everyone should probably take. It's very thorough. I've been pretty much everywhere in the city, and I've just really been enjoying it and been enjoying the orchestra. So welcome to Rachmaninoff and the Hollywood Sound. If you've opened your program books, you'll notice that it says this concert is, I think, The Great Gatsby or something. That was the last one, so I'm sorry if you came here for that. This will indeed be Rachmaninoff. So, you know, when the orchestra tasked me with coming as a guest to create a program, I didn't know this orchestra really at all. I've had some friends from the area who told me nice things. But I thought that this would be a nice introduction because, to me, I mean, everybody loves Rachmaninoff. I could be wrong about that. But Rachmaninoff also, to me, has this deep connection to all of these film composers that we're going to hear today. And film music, if you're a fan of it, you may know that it doesn't get as much time as it should in the concert hall. I think it's really fantastic music. And a lot of these composers studied to be great opera writers and symphonists and violin concerto writers and all of these things. And so why not bring them here onto the concert hall and give them their due time. So that's what we're doing today. But why Rachmaninoff? He was not really a film composer. Although, as a friend of mine said, you can call this Rachmaninoff and the Hollywood Sound, but depending on the movie, Rachmaninoff is the Hollywood Sound. His music has been used in quite a few films. David Lean's Brief Encounter, which I actually haven't seen. Maybe some of you have seen this film. Marilyn Monroe was in 7 Year Itch. There's also a Clint Eastwood movie which uses his music. But you may or may not also know that he moved to Hollywood. So he's a Russian composer. He moved to the United States. A lot of composers lived in Hollywood, actually. I actually went on Google Maps the other day to have a look. He lived, I think, 12 or 11 minutes from Igor Stravinsky in Beverly Hills. And they lived there for quite some time and didn't talk to each other. Apparently, the story goes, Rachmaninoff wanted to get to know this other great Russian composer. So he showed up to his door, I think it was late at night actually, with inexplicably a jar of honey. And he knocked on the door and said, "Mr. Stravinsky, do you like honey?" "Thank you. Okay, come on in." So very, very unexpected, but they never really made a deep connection. But even though he was there in Hollywood, he didn't write much himself, but he inspired, I think, all of these composers that we're going to hear today. So what do we have to offer? The first piece of music on the program is the Casablanca Suite by Max Steiner. And he is appropriately named the father of orchestral film music, Max Steiner is, because he wrote King Kong back in, I think it was 1933, you can correct me if I'm wrong. At that time, nobody understood that film music should be orchestral music. I mean, this place in particular, a lot of places were built for the silent movies, and they would have, I hear there's an organ here, actually, they would have some interesting organ or perhaps a little tiny band in the pit, and they would provide the music, and it might be anything from Johann Strauss to some popular music. But King Kong, with Max Steiner, he convinced the director to let him write for full orchestra. And they said, "Well, we're not going to pay for that." So if I remember correctly, Steiner paid for it himself. And it paid off because now nobody needed to be convinced after this movie that orchestral music should absolutely be a part of film music. And it added so much to the film. In fact, King Kong seems so dated now, of course, but the music is really the thing that we remember. And he was born in 1888. So here's another connection. He was 12 years old when Rachmaninoff's second concerto was written. So a lot of these composers actually grew up hearing this kind of music in their early life. So I told you, King Kong, Casablanca, he also wrote Gone with the Wind, one of the most iconic scores. I think he wrote actually over 300 film scores. I don't know how he possibly could have done that in his time, but you know, this is kind of a natural bridge to me between people like Wagner or Beethoven or Brahms into the film world. For example, Steiner used this technique called Leitmotiv, which Wagner used in his operas. Every character had to have a specific theme attached to them, which is very effective. And you can also use it in sort of psychological ways. Like, for example, John Williams does this a lot in Star Wars. Yoda has a theme, Leia has a theme, we all know Darth Vader has a theme. But perhaps there's a little hint. By the way, if you haven't seen Star Wars, spoiler alert here. There may be a little hint that Darth Vader is perhaps someone's father, because his theme is buried underneath the texture when that person is on camera. So Steiner was the first person to bring that into the film world. And this piece, actually, the Casablanca, is the only one on the first half that I've ever conducted. I did the entire film with the Vancouver Symphony. Maybe some of you have come to the film concerts here. It's a lot of fun. That was a horrifying experience for me because there was almost no tech involved in this film. There were no click tracks or punches or streamers. I had just a video like spliced in of an analog clock with a second hand. And I had to watch that, and who can even read an analog clock anymore? So I was trying to do the math and then look at my score and see where I was. And on top of that, if you know the film, there's a lot of music performance in the film. Sam the pianist, you may have heard Play It Again, Sam. They don't say that in the film, by the way. It's Play It Once, Sam. So now you know something fun. Sam plays, there's a guitarist, there's a whole bar full of people singing, and the orchestra has to accompany that. And it's quite a challenge, but also it's just glorious music. You're, of course, going to hear As Time Goes By, the really fantastic song that was used throughout this film. Apparently, when Steiner was asked to score it, he told the director, Can we get rid of this song? I don't want to deal with this song. It's just some trifle. And he said, actually, no, it's integral to the film. So he went the other direction, and he imbued that theme into the score. And it becomes representative of whatever emotional content is happening at the time between maybe Rick and Ilsa or anything that could be going on in the war. So it's really a beautiful film. You're going to hear La Marseillaise in a very triumphant way. You're going to hear a lot of different sounds, which maybe Steiner thought he was being exotic. So he added finger cymbals and a snaky sounding oboe and a tam-tam and all of these things. He probably had never been to Morocco, but that was his idea of how it sounded. And it's not too bad. So I think that's a fitting beginning to this program. And then we move in a slightly different direction with Bernard Herrmann. Now, he was American born, but of Ukrainian Russian Jewish descent. And he famously, you know, many movies that he wrote. He wrote Citizen Kane. And I mention Citizen Kane because he quotes a piece by Rachmaninoff in that movie, The Isle of the Dead, which uses the Dies Irae, or the sort of ghastly song that you hear also in The Shining and anytime you're thinking about death or anything like that. But he's very famous for his Hitchcock collaborations. I think, did he write Rear Window? What's the one about, is it North by Northwest? Yeah, I think maybe Vertigo. I don't think he wrote Birds, but I could be wrong about that. But a lot of things with Hitchcock, and I think it's a great connection. He also wrote scores for Orson Welles and François Truffaut, and one of my favorites, Taxi Driver, was actually his last film. I just rewatched it last week, and that shows you a lot of his range. It's more of a jazz score than anything else. But we all know, I think, the murder scene in this film. But maybe the rest of the score is not so familiar. But I think it's all fantastic, and he has this ability to show tension. For example, the first movement is extremely fast and sort of knotty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, I mean, these rhythms and this sort of snarling string writing. He tells them to not use vibrato. He wants it to be almost a very brutal sound, so you'll hear that, which is quite a contrast from the sweeping melodies of Rachmaninoff, but I thought we'd throw in a little diversity in our sound, so that's why I included this wonderful score. Actually, today, some of you may know the principal trumpet here, Mark, backstage brought me over to his trumpet case, and he said, I brought something for you, and I was a little afraid. He brought like a 10-pound meat cleaver. And he said, maybe if you feel like it, you can conduct psycho with this thing. I said, don't think that would be a wise choice. He's very safe in the back of the orchestra. So we have, we've got a little Steiner, that classic Hollywood sound. We've got the more avant-garde sound of Bernard Herrmann. And then we move to a living composer, the only one on this list, Joe Hisaishi. How many people have seen a Studio Ghibli film? Anybody in here? Okay, I see a couple people under the age of 30 who say yes. So I think all of you should see these films because it's been a discovery for me this year. It's in the genre of anime, but it's really this classic anime. Miyazaki is the director and the illustrator, and he has this team of artistic people doing Studio Ghibli, and they have many, many films. Many of them are scored by Hisaishi. It's just the most gorgeous animation you've ever seen. I can't believe how beautiful it is. And so Hisaishi has written many, many film scores for this group. Hisaishi is not actually his name. His name is, let's see if I can remember it. No, I can't. I'm sorry. But he got his stage name, Joe Hisaishi, from his love for Quincy Jones. If you say Quincy in Japanese, it sounds a little bit like Hisaishi. And Jones becomes Joe Hisaishi. Fun little fact. So we're playing music from Howl's Moving Castle, which actually is an anti-war kind of piece. This is one of the many themes in Studio Ghibli, also environmentalism, mythology, sort of a lot of old Japanese mythology. Also, Miyazaki, the director and the illustrator, loved to fly. I think he even had a pilot's license. So there's a lot of flying that goes on in his music, in his movies, and therefore in the Hisaishi music as well. So take a look at these films. They're all on Netflix. Many of them are anyway. And you'll have something to talk about with your Zoomer friends. So we move from Hisaishi then to Nino Rota. Going to the Italian world here for a moment, he scored the Godfather soundtrack. And he was born in 1911, so definitely grew up hearing Rachmaninoff, and was, of course, he was alive at that time as well, Rachmaninoff was. He worked a lot with Fellini and Visconti. He wrote the music for La Strada, which is a fantastic film score. But Nino Rota was also a very serious classical composer. He liked to write in the style called dodecaphony, or 12-tone music that was created by Arnold Schoenberg and Alban Berg, and all of you are saying, yes, that's my favorite music ever written. I mention that because when you hear this piece of music, you would never know that. He had a massive range of style, so he could stay on the avant-garde of contemporary music. At the same time, he could write a beautiful Italian folk melody. That's not easy. A lot of gritty sort of avant-garde composers would never dream of writing a melody. You know, why would I do that? I want to be in this avant-garde 12-tone school. But he could do it. And Godfather, Part 1, fun fact, was released, maybe some of you saw this in the New York Times, was released 50 years ago this week, on the 15th, I believe it was. And the score won Best Original Motion Picture Score. It was quickly rescinded, actually, because it turns out he used the love theme in a different film, and that was not allowed. So they took the Oscar back, but 2 years later, he won it again for Godfather Part II. So all is well. I really love this score, is one of the reasons I put it in there, but I also think it's deeply connected to Rachmaninoff, and the string writing in particular is very similar. It's so lush, and the melodies seem to just never end. There's also a piano in the orchestra, but one of the most interesting colors, I think, in the orchestra that you're going to hear, and see if you can find it on stage, it's a bit of a Where's Waldo situation, there's a mandolin in the orchestra. And so it just brings you back to some sort of warm afternoon in a piazza in Sicily or something. Oh, you've already found it. Yes. So it's a colorful score. It's one of my favorites, and I think it sounds a lot like Rachmaninoff, which is another reason I chose it. The final piece on the first half is by Korngold, and I think it's quite funny. This year seems to be a Korngold festival. For those of you who have been coming to all the concerts, I think there are three different programs with Korngold. I never hear Korngold live, so it's a wonderful chance to kind of explore his music. He was born in 1897. He was an Austrian Jew. Clearly in his early 30s, it was not a good time to be an Austrian Jew, and he fled to the United States. But he did so because of this offer that he got to write Robin Hood, and it was just a really fortuitous situation for him. He won an Oscar for this film, but it's funny when he finally got to the U.S. and he watched the film, he didn't like it, and he said, maybe I don't want to do this. Can I get out of this contract? And they said, no, it's a contract. You have to write this film. He didn't want to write for an action movie. He thought he was too serious of a composer to kind of take that on. Well, clearly, his score was extremely memorable, and we still play it to this day. And personally, I think it's the best thing about the movie. He, later in his life, kind of went full circle and became this quote-unquote serious classical composer. And I think you've already heard, was it Much Ado About Nothing, Sweet? Is that what maybe you saw the last concert here? Was that him? Yeah, I wasn't obviously not in town. So you heard some of his music. I think you might be hearing again the violin concerto. So he wrote operas. He wrote a violin concerto. He wrote all of this music. But he wasn't afraid to imbue that with the sound of film. He was sort of unabashedly romantic at a time, honestly, when that was going out of fashion. But having been connected to that Hollywood world, he knew that it was still very much a marketable thing, and he continued to do it. So all of these film composers, as I said, I connected them to Rachmaninoff. Sometimes it might be slightly a stretch, but I don't think it necessarily is. We have a tremendous guest artist here making her debut in Rockford. I think she's already played in Chicago, but not here in Rockford yet, Wei Luo. And I met her when I was listening to some rehearsals of the San Diego Symphony, and she was playing the Prokofiev third piano concerto. And from the first notes, I just had to know all about her. Who is this person? Because this sounds incredible. And I just knew, this was 2 years ago, maybe three, that she was a rising star. And so it's going to be a real treat. I think this is right in her repertoire. And we've been working really hard to make this a flexible performance. There's a lot of give and take and a lot of communication. Now, Rachmaninoff, as many of you know, was a pianist. You can go and listen to his recordings, actually. To say he was a pianist is a pretty severe understatement. He was an incredible pianist. But he was one of those rare soloists who also knew how to write for the orchestra. Unlike, I'm sorry to say, Chopin, who's, you know, orchestral writing, it's fine. It needs a little help sometimes. Or even, in my mind, someone like Paganini, you know. Liszt maybe is an example of someone who writes very well for orchestras, but Rachmaninoff absolutely was. And he wrote pieces for orchestra alone. A lot of people like Chopin only wrote when there was a piano involved. But Rachmaninoff was famous for his hands, which were extremely large. He could reach a 12th on the piano. So that's an octave plus a lot more. Now, most pianists cannot reach a 12th. So how do they play this music? Well, it's a kind of a trick of rolling, you know, playing the bottom note and jumping up as quick as you can to the upper chord. I think that's how most people get around it. He was a tremendous pianist. He got very famous in his early years for the C-sharp prelude, which he wrote in his teens. It became a hit. It was like Billboard Top 40 hit. Of course, no one else could really play it at the time, except for him, so he toured around doing this. Then he wrote his first symphony. And this is a big leap, actually, for a composer to write their first symphony. I just did recently Brahms' second symphony, and I was thinking about this because it took Brahms 14 years to write his first symphony because he felt the shadow of Beethoven sort of hovering over him. How do you write your first symphony after Beethoven had recently finished writing perfect 9 symphonies in a row? So Rachmaninoff didn't wait 14 years. He kind of jumped right in, and it was not a success. Rachmaninoff had a dismal failure, and it wasn't only his fault. The orchestra was ill-prepared. I can't remember if it was Glazunov conducting or if he was just around, but he was this great composer who also was a person who would write critiques of different concerts. Well, Glazunov was so drunk that he was falling out of his chair. So that didn't help things either. So the concert did not go well. The reviews were terrible. And Rachmaninoff took this very personally because this is like his baby that he's putting forth to the world. And he fell into a great depression, so much that he couldn't write. He didn't want to eat. He didn't want to do anything. He just stayed in his home. And this went on for so long that finally somebody said, well, I think you should really do something about this. We're worried about you. There's this guy down the street named Dr. Nikolai Dahl, and he's a hypnotherapist. Maybe you should try that. And now this was, of course, right maybe around the year 1900. So this was an early technique inspired by mesmerism, which, you know, was kind of quasi-scientific and maybe more charlatanism, but edging towards scientific. And then it started to become an accepted part of psychotherapy. So he went and saw this guy, and he went through hypnosis every single day for something like 3 months. And apparently it worked, because at the end of that time, he said that he was cured. And the very first thing that he wrote was this second piano concerto. So this piece was his emergence from that really, really dark place in his life. And he was so thankful to this guy, Nikolai Dahl, that he dedicated this concerto to him. So it's really an interesting thing to keep in perspective, because the opening of the piece is very interesting. It's piano alone. It's this really somber moment, and it kind of builds out of nothing in this massive crescendo. And then the orchestra joins in with this melody that is just one of his best. The whole string section is playing it in unison, except for the basses, which are just plodding along this sort of march-like rhythm. And to me, it sounds like a 1,000-voice-strong choir made of only bass voices. I don't know if you ever heard any of these kind of choirs. Really, really powerful opening. But to me, the very beginning also is reminiscent of the sound of Orthodox Russian bells. So the pianist plays one chord, and then they play a low F on the bottom. Another chord, another low F. Another chord, another low F. Every time this F happens, I see this giant bell being hit, because that's the kind of sound that he would hear growing up in this Russian Orthodox world all around him. So I think it's one of the most powerful pieces that he wrote, and of course it starts in a very somber way, but it ends in an extremely triumphant one, and I do hope you will continue applauding so we can just beg Wei Luo to give us an encore, because I think it's going to be truly fantastic. So I wanted to just leave, I don't know if this is a tradition here in Rockford, but I wanted to leave a moment maybe for any of you to ask any questions about the program that you might have before we let the musicians come on stage. They do have to warm up, and I have to change clothes. Are there any questions you might have about the program or about anything except for politics, perhaps? Two harps? You want to know why there are two harps? Two harps are better than one. I wish they were right here in the front of the stage. How did you know there are two harps? There are not two harps here. Okay, so you knew. You have a good reason to know. So, I mean, I think when you think of Hollywood sound, harps, right, is a really big element to that. And harps are relatively quiet, so I think when you double them, it helps. Obviously, in a film studio, you have a mic right on the harp. That glissando sound you hear in so many sort of dream sequences, and it's become a little cliche, but at the time it wasn't. It was just very effective. And I'm trying to remember which piece uses both of those harps, but it goes back maybe all the way to Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique uses two harps. And I've actually done it by putting them in the front, and people love that because it's a beautiful thing to watch. So yeah, look out for the two harps. I think there are about 7 percussionists back there, which is going to be a lot of fun. There's a celesta and a piano and a contrabassoon and all manner of things over there. It's a really colorful program. Yeah. Anything else anyone's dying to know? They're very shy here tonight. Okay. Well, you had your chance. I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's one of the most enjoyable programs I've done in a while, and I will say I've just felt very welcomed here in Rockford. And you have a real gem in this orchestra, and it's not something that just exists on its own. It really takes the support of people like you who show up early to pre-concert talks, who open your wallets and come to concerts and spread the word and bring new people into the concert hall. So I really hope you enjoy the program tonight. Thank you very much.